Should I say Happy New Year? Or should I just go ahead with the podcast? This is our first of 2022 Paleo Protestant podcast with three confessional Protestants, all of whom teach at Hillsdale College in the history department and get along quite well, even though we worship in separate parishes or congregations. And this week we're going to talk, or this episode, we're going to talk about what I guess we could call Protestant Constantinianism, partly inspired by some Protestants who are critical, confessional Protestants who are critical of liberalism. This would exclude a lot of the, I think, what I would call fairly silly evangelical pushback on it, which seems kind of predictable and fashionable from perhaps folks associated with Christianity Today magazine or even the Dispatch. Don't need to name any sources there. This also gets into the questions about Christendom, secular, political polity, which all of us teach here in the Western Heritage, American Heritage courses. So in some ways, it's quite relevant to what we do at Hillsdale, but also strikes me as being relevant to our understandings of our particular communions. So I guess I'd like to start with talking particularly about two kingdom sorts of perspectives on this, and the Lutherans in particular, as I've followed some of the debates, and I'll try to put some links in the so-called show notes about this, but it doesn't seem like Lutherans are as prominent in this as self-identifiably Lutheran voices. And one way of, say, thinking about this is with the Constantinian order of some kind. Presbyterians, if you go back to the Westminster Confession, are as bad as Constantinian as you could be in the original Westminster Confession. It says of the civil magistrate, paragraph 3 of chapter 23, the civil magistrate has authority and it is duty to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the church and that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed. That sounds to me a lot like Constantine. And that's written by Westminster divines, Church of England people in the 1640s, even as they were commissioned by Parliament, who's at war with the king. And many of those Westminster divines aren't entirely comfortable with episcopacy. And then, of course, those words in the Westminster Confession get revised by American Presbyterians in 1789. And they don't talk about the magistrate that way. They talk about the magistrate as a nursing father who can help religious groups. But it seems to me, the way I read it, all sorts of religious groups, not simply Presbyterians or even just Protestants. But what's striking to me in thinking about this, and this is a long-winded way to wind up, and I apologize, but the Presbyterians who wrote the Westminster Confession and Independence, Anglicanism is in their head, just as I think for Anglicans, Presbyterianism is in their head to a certain extent. And Lutherans aren't around that much for these conversations. And here I think about the map that one of our colleagues here circulated of Europe, roughly 1444. Brad did it, if you can remember back to that incredibly detailed and colorful map. It's a great map, and I've used it with students. And the German-speaking territories are just like there's a gazillion of them. It's like the number of dancers up on the stage in Las Vegas. And I wonder how much the lack of political unity, centralization, even though you do have an emperor, but Frederick III, Luther's prince, who's Roman Catholic, is there something about the political waters of Central Europe, the German-speaking Europe in particular, that gives Lutherans a different perspective? Because in England or Scotland, you have a monarchy, and you have a pretty coherent set of political institutions that are pointing more and more toward centralization with the Union of 1707. But do Lutherans think about this differently, perhaps because there are so many princes, so many territories, and they're Lutheran and Roman Catholic ones, obviously after the Reformation? I'll stop there.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say, no, they don't necessarily think differently. So for example, and of course, things are going to change, shift over time. Continental Lutheranism in the 16th and 17th century is different from American Lutheranism. Even if we're still reading the same confessions, it gets cashed out a little bit differently, especially in terms of two kingdoms, church-state issues, etc. But when the 16th century Lutherans, for example, are still somewhat optimistic in their dealings with the Emperor Charles V, they're perfectly happy to tell him that, you know, as emperor, his first and primary duty is to maintain sound doctrine. Even though he's not a priest, he's not a pastor, he's just an emperor. That's his first and foremost duty. And they don't really shed that idea that in principle the magistrate does have a duty to maintain sound doctrine. They just give up on Catholic magistrates actually doing that. And so once you get past something like the Peace of Augsburg that does allow the independent territorial magistrates to determine, okay, I'm Lutheran, so my realm is going to be Lutheran, they're pretty content with that, because the emperor is still the emperor, but my elector or my prince, I'm still going to remind him that his first duty is to maintain pure doctrine. And as long as he's doing that, we're on board.
And what if he doesn't do it?
And if he doesn't do it, that's a good question. There's lots of grousing. There's lots of table pounding. It's a real question. Happily in early days, it doesn't become a real issue. Except in those couple of cases later on, where you say you have a territorial magistrate who is Lutheran and then becomes Reformed, that causes all sorts of consternation and legal questions about what's legal under the Peace of Augsburg or later under the Peace of Westphalia. This is one of the things that American Lutherans can become quite shocked about when they read Luther, when they read Melanchthon, when they read the 17th century Orthodox Lutherans, and they've heard two kingdoms, two kingdoms, two kingdoms, and for whatever reason, they've associated that with church and state. And so they're not quite sure how to wrap their head around the fact that none of these early Lutherans seem super keen on kind of separation of church and state, and actually seem pretty keen on reminding the magistrates that they actually have a duty to promote and protect right doctrine.
And one last question before letting Miles have a chance here. How much are finances a factor, either in, say, that how much does the church depend on the state for funding? Or does it have its own independent budget lines or not? So that if it grouses too much, could the prince or elector say, well, I'm going to cut you off, or you're not going to have as many pastors? Or
That is certainly a real question in, for example, modern Germany, whether you're Lutheran or Catholic or otherwise, because people are paying a church tax, and that's going back to the churches. And far more people pay the church tax and never show up in church. So there's plenty of money to be had via the state. I don't think it's so much a concern in the Reformation era itself. And I don't know when that becomes, certainly by the 19th century. But I think the concern very early on, the more explicit concern isn't that we have to stay on the right side of the prince because he's paying the bills. As it is, we have to stay on the right side of the prince because he's the only one that's going to protect us if an imperial army attempts to sweep in and force us to go back to saying the Roman Mass.
Well, Presbyterians have the remedy for that. You form your own. So, Miles, what's the Anglican take on Constantinianism and or Christendom?
I don't think it's that different from the Lutheran take in a lot of ways. I think that the thing that, if you want to call something that's essentially Anglican, is just the understanding that the state is real. And that's something that didn't change when the Episcopal Church was formed at the beginning of the end of this 18th and beginning of the 19th century. I think because there's an understanding the state's real, the Anglican is understand at on some level the church is going to have a relationship with the state. So the question is not whether or not the church has a relationship with the state, it's what nature that relationship takes. So I think Anglicans would be very quick, and even in the United States, guys who were firm disestablishmentarians who would be horrified at the idea of a state church are very clear that we have a relationship with the state. And that's a lot of that came from the fact that, of course, Anglicanism is predicated upon Episcopal governance. There's a guy named Stephen Elliott. He was the Bishop of Georgia. And the secession crisis is really useful for this conversation because, okay, you're a church in a state within a federal state. How do you determine what your lay people are supposed to do, right? This question of allegiance isn't merely a political one. It becomes an ecclesiastical one as well. And Stephen Elliott, his argument, and it's one that's been accepted broadly, at least in the United States, is that Episcopal bishops are bishops because of the church existing within a certain political paradigm, in a certain polity. They're not bishops because they're bishops. They're bishops because there's people within this polity that are Anglicans and they need a bishop. And so because of that, I think there's this understanding that there's essential kind of almost creative animus that the state has for a church within it. Right, there will always be churches within states. And this is where you see a comment like King James is be really important. When he says, no king, no bishops, he's not merely saying, if you get rid of bishops, you'll get rid of the king. He's saying that, look, kings create the polities that bishops have to rule. So that relationship is just really kind of a symbiotic one. So there's no sort of state of nature for Anglicans about their relationship with the state. It's also interesting to note that they, much less than Presbyterians, talk about the state. And there's no really, message about monarchy or message about republic or message about establishment in the 39 Articles, because it's assumed, of course, we'll have a relationship with the state. States are things that exist, and so the church has to exist within them. And so it's pretty different, I think, than the Reformed, mainly because the Reformed talk about it. I think the Reformed think about it more. And your point about Presbyterians kind of always having Anglicanism in the back of their head is a good one. I don't know if Anglicans always have Presbyterianism in the back of their head. I think they have anyone who wants to attack the state and vis-a-vis the church in the back of the head. So whoever that is, that kind of nameless enemy, is who Anglicans think about. It might have been the Puritans, it might have been the Congregationalist Puritans, it might have been Presbyterians, it might be Catholics. But that's sort of, I think, the enemy for Anglicans. So it's just very much assumed.
Yeah.
So you can't get not to get too nerdy, but yeah. I mean, this... something you said reminds me of. So, for example, in the run up to the English Civil Wars, Laud and the so called High Church Party or Arminian Party is a constant bogeyman for normal conformist Anglicans, and certainly the Puritan wing. But one of the most consistent criticisms of the Laudian faction is that they have a kind of crypto separatist ideology, that they think of themselves as bishops who do not necessarily have a relationship with the state and who can act independently of the state. And they're worried, and this gets a little confusing. We hear and we see in various political documents the sort of charge that Charles I is, you know, a royal absolutist and therefore kind of an arbitrary king and a tyrant. But a lot of the Puritan rhetoric with respect to Charles isn't that he's acting tyrannously, it's that he's kind of abdicating his responsibility and letting the church, namely the bishops, too free a rein to do whatever they want, introducing new ceremonies, new liturgies, persecute Protestants. And there's a very interesting parallel. We think of Anglo-Catholicism within the Anglican Communion, primarily for being a kind of high church movement, like the earlier Laudian movement is. But in their beginnings, they are very explicitly hoping for a separation of church and state.
Right.
So it's kind of interesting that I think
and that's just to be clear about that for people who don't know maybe 19th century history and that's because the state in England in the 19th century has basically granted rights to people outside the church.
Getting too lax.
The church has become right. The state has become lax. The church now finds itself one among many, seemingly. Right. So they would like either to go back to an older arrangement or then to have a more separate,
right?
Separate in a way.
Yeah. And this is an accusation that gets thrown around a lot in the 1830s and 1840s, at the beginning of the Tractarian controversy. It's the Tractarian. Impulse is not to go to Parliament and sort of imprint their views. In fact, they're viewed as the problem, and the rest, you know, old high churchmen, what we might call evangelicals within the Church of England, are begging Parliament to discipline, the Tractarians. And I think that's a great point. I mean, J.C. Ryle, who's kind of a well-known evangelical within the Church of England in the 19th century, I mean, he constantly is telling people in sermons, make sure you go tell your MP, tell somebody if your rector is saying popish things, because you have a legal right. Hmm. You have a legal right. He says that in one of his little sermonettes. He says you have a legal right to have your rector bound to the articles. And so what's interesting is Parliament's really doing a lot of what we might call confessional policing in the British context. And I think Corey's point's well taken, that the roots of that in the 17th century. One of the reasons why a figure like Laud is so hated is because he's viewed as flaunting Parliament's authority. Corey knows as much and probably more than I do about Anglicans in the early 17th century, but so it's much different than say Americans tend to think of it, which is the government will be the boogeyman, the government will mess things up. And for a lot of Anglican history, really right up until the end of the 19th century, the idea is, please Parliament, come deal with these guys who are acting out, because the bishops aren't going to.
So Presbyterian perspective, as I've come to understand it more so, and it's there even in American Presbyterianism, but it's a refrain throughout, which is the idea of the independence of the church, that Christ is king of the church, not king or queen of England. And you can get into what the headship of the crown means for the Church of England, which isn't true for the Church of Scotland. But there is a sense in which Presbyterians would assert, even if they also want to hold on to an establishment, that we don't need the state. Darn it. You know, and it sounds to me a little bit like Lutherans and Anglicans might think that there is a kind of dependent or codependent relationship with the state. That's, I'm not saying that to say Presbyterians are superior, but it does lead to this issue when we think about Constantine and Constantinianism. I mean, a big debate between Anglicans and Presbyterians is over the nature of the early church before Constantine. And what was the church polity then? And there you don't have a state that is particularly inclined to Christians. Yes, persecution waxes and wanes, but there's nothing like an establishment there. And you can get into the nature of the episcopate in the early church, but it's still not one that is cozy with the state. And Presbyterians, you know, it's to their advantage to say that the council at Ephesus or the council at Jerusalem looks a lot like what a presbytery or a general assembly would be. So they may be cooking the books that way. But it's also the case that they could say, look, at this is church government before you have a Christian emperor. And then after 1789, whether in the European context with France or the American context with the Bill of Rights, you know, you could conceivably argue, as I have at times, that this is a kind of a return to a pre-Constantinian arrangement where the church is not going to be dependent. It's going to be independent of the state. And we did it once. Christ and Paul and Peter didn't seem to think that an establishment was necessary. Maybe Christ knew it because he was divine and he could think what was coming. But so why? It's another long-winded way of asking whether liberalism of the American kind is really that bad a thing, especially the way contemporary conservative Christians, whether Protestant or Roman Catholic, are conceiving it. Now, again, looking at liberalism of the 18th, 19th century variety compared to post Obergefell, post Fauci, post, I don't know where you want to go with that. I mean, I certainly have major reservations about the American order right now. But I still, as an American, and I think as a Presbyterian, think it's okay to say this, that I want to hold on to the bones of the American Republic and the American constitutional order, and still think there's a lot there to work with. And even as bad as things have become, say morally, in the United States, which has been a theme of my whole life, going back to the 60s. But you know, there's no one telling our congregation or the OPC, my denomination, how we should conduct our affairs. I mean, so far we still have an amazing amount of freedom. Our website has not been shut down. Our magazine still, you know, is delivered through the U.S. mails, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so how much is liberalism a problem?
Yeah, no, this is a really good question. And I mean, I would second for the Lutherans, your comments about, you know, Constantine and the pre-Constantinian order. You know, the idea is not that, you know, the state is somehow necessary to the support and good ordering of the church. You know, the church existed before Constantine did, and it was persecuted, but it, you know, it was a true church. And so I think the question, I mean, you're right. The question becomes, so was Christendom a good thing or a bad thing?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think the obvious answer is, well, both. And so the question for us becomes, you know, what is a cozy relationship between church and state prudent? Will it accomplish what we hope it will accomplish? And that's where you kind of look, you know, to history and say, well, did it actually accomplish what previous Christians hoped it would accomplish? Or did it in some ways undermine what they hoped it would accomplish? So I'm not, I mean, for example, There are those who think, well, obviously the conversion of Constantine, the favoring of Christianity from Constantine forward was obviously good, because that's where you see the church growing. And that, you know, the legalization of Christianity, the favoring of Christianity was necessary for the church to really come into its own. Statistically, I don't think that's the case. I think that the rate of Christianization, if you want to use that sociological term, is exactly the same before Constantine as after Constantine. But it's an exponential growth. And so right around the beginning of the 14th century, in absolute numbers, that growth is huge, but it's not actually at a rate that's any different than pre-Constantine. So I don't think the conversion of Constantine or the favoring of Christianity makes a huge difference for the actual growth of the church. It might make a difference when you get to things like the Arian controversy in terms of, you know, arranging, organizing, funding an ecumenical council for the protection of the church. So, I mean, it's an open question. Well, and let me just say this, so I don't hog the mic too long. If you read, you know, the church fathers from, you know, say Constantine through the next two centuries, they're constantly back and forth, you know, either praising the emperor to the high heavens for his involvement in church affairs, or excoriating the emperors to high heaven for his involvement in church affairs. And it's as if it never dawns on them that there's like a principle at stake here, except insofar as the principle is we're happy to have the emperor on our side and involved if he's doing what we think is right. And if he's doing what we think is wrong, then to hell with him.
So it's like blue and red America, all the way back there.
No, that's right. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, I said I wasn't going to hog the mic, but I mean, just to bring it back to Lutherans, I mean, this is exactly the case, and you know, partly the origins of the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. Lutherans were perfectly happy to have a Lutheran prince or a Lutheran king, insofar as he was Lutheran and he was upholding, or at least, you know, kind of allowing the Lutheran Church to be the Lutheran Church. But when he attempts to sort of coerce a union with Reformed churches, or, you know, prevent them from singing X number of verses in any given hymn, then they said, "Yeah, sorry, we can't listen to you anymore. We're leaving."
Just a parenthetical, well, somewhat parenthetically, but a statistic that I've heard about the fourth century from Rodney Stark, I believe it was, is that the church, you know, and who knows what, how many church members there were in the empire.
Sure.
It's, you know, what kind of record keeping was actually being done. But, and this is one of the reasons why having state churches is actually a pretty good deal, because the records then last. But it's roughly 10% of the population is Christian in 300, the way he right. tells it. By 350, though, he says it's upwards of 50%. And he uses, I think, that point to say that Christianity became more attractive once it became, I mean, official or political or respectable in a way. So I don't, is that, are those figures you think fair? Yeah,
no, I think the figures are fair. I mean, as fair as they can be, given the kinds of records and stuff that you're looking at. But no, it's Stark is one of the people that makes the point that, yeah, you see this enormous jump in those 50 years. And then by the time you get to the end of the fourth century, we're looking at 90%. But the looks are deceiving, because that growth rate, what was it, like 40% per decade, is exactly the same growth rate that he's estimating from Pentecost until the year 300. So it did. The change looks huge, and numerically it is, but the rate of growth is exactly the same. It looks different because the growth is exponential. You know, 40% of, you know, 120 believers on the day of Pentecost over the next decade isn't huge growth numerically, even if it's if it is percentage wise.
So over to Anglicans, Miles, and liberalism. And I mean, the Anglican Church, Church of England, had close ties with the Tory party.
Right.
So it would have been conservative in outlook. The Whigs would have been the outlet for nonconformist or dissenting Protestants, and even sometimes Roman Catholics who are in a minority in England, but in a majority in Ireland, and that whether that lasts or not is another question. But so, I mean, given that political, and thinking back to what you talked about with the Tractarians, is there something that makes Anglicanism more establishmentarian and more conservative in the European sense than, say, in the American Reaganite sense?
Yeah, in England and Ireland, it's definitely wedded to what we might call conservatism, right? It was hard to be a really, really enthusiastic churchman and be, no matter what your churchmanship was, whether you're evangelical or old high churchman or broad church, whatever, it was really hard to be really into the idea of churchmanship and be a convinced Whig, right? I mean, you have all sorts of records of it, well into the 1880s, of Church of England rectors come general election time, basically using their pulpits as, you know, mouthpieces for the Tory party. And of course, the inverse of that, as you mentioned, is nonconformists like Charles Spurgeon use his pulpit as a mouthpiece for the Liberal Party. You know, I mean, the Metropolitan Tabernacle was the Liberal Party's headquarters in South London, which I don't think a lot of people realize. I think this question of Christendom for Anglicans is a rhetorical one more than a confessional one. So, you know, sort of what does Christendom mean? What does the liberal order mean? You know, Winston Churchill, when he talks about Christendom, when he talks about Christian civilization, is basically talking about what we would call liberal Western life. So they're a synonym for him. You know, the famous, you know, finest hour speech, he says basically beating the Nazis, he says, upon it depends Christian civilization. Mm. So I think it's a civilizational question. I don't know if I think establishmentarianism for Anglicans is adiaphora. We don't really need, the church doesn't need it to win souls, right? But I think also there's sort of, at least historically, John Fox's writing is so instructive, because I think if you read the way Anglicans talk in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, there's not the sort of, I don't know a better way to say it, there's not the sort of martyr porn that you have in nonconformist writing. Anglicans aren't like, oh yeah, we want, like, martyrdom grows the church. Yeah, let's sign up for that. And the reason why they're not like that is because they remember the Marian martyrs, right? The Church of England's founded in martyrdom, but it also doesn't celebrate it the same way other groups do. So I think for a lot of people, they're like, look, a state church is a good thing because we like civilization. We don't want to get killed. And so I think it's not as, it's just a different type of conversation. You know, civilizational aspects of what you might call Christendom tend to be the way that Anglicans use the term. So it's not a program. I think in among the Reformed, there's like a program of Christendom. Like, if we do this, if we do this, if we do this, we'll make Christendom. And for Anglicans, it tends to be a rhetorical, almost synonymous with what we might call, you know, liberal civilization. And so they just don't talk about it the same way as especially modern Reformed types do. So I think the taxonomy doesn't translate exactly.
Yeah, I guess I would say, and I want to use this as a way to talk to Corey, raise a question with Corey about the LCMS in America, but I mean, I think the way you just described it, Miles, works for pre-Vantillian or pre-Kuyperian Presbyterians, where the ideas of liberty and freedom, freedom of conscience, all that good Whiggish stuff go hand in hand with Protestantism, even sometimes triumphalistically with Presbyterians. So there is this kind of world of markets and trade and commerce and work ethic and political freedoms, et cetera, that Presbyterians are sort of claiming as, you know, Christian civilization as well, more so in the 19th century. But, you know, in the American setting, it becomes odder in a way to do that, especially when you get so much religious diversity, and then that freedom extends to groups who are not Christian, and what do you do with that? Or even to people who are anti-Christian, and what do you do with that? But Corey, I was curious in something you said earlier about the LCMS folks, or some people might be surprised about separation of church and state not being part of the Lutheran model. Yeah. So when the LCMS comes to America, or those Lutherans who form the LCMS come to America, how long does it take for them to kind of become pro 1789, or is it take until the 20th century? Until Ronald Reagan?
No, that's a good question. I'm kind of just cribbing from very scant recollections of a couple of articles by someone like Cameron McKenzie, who teaches down the road in Fort Wayne. He's got an essay which suggests that it happens almost immediately. That already with CFW Walther, who is, you know, the first president of the LCMS, first president of the seminary in St. Louis, that there's a kind of reworking of classical Lutheran Two Kingdoms theology away from a distinction between internal and external towards something much more closely approximating the distinction between church and state. I don't recall that he attempts to tease out why this happens, if it's just a sort of confusion of categories, or if it's kind of intentional compromise with American culture and American sentiment. But I seem to recall this is his suggestion, that from the start, American Lutherans are still working with those Two Kingdoms categories, but they've slightly rejiggered them so that they're not exactly what the old world Lutherans meant by them.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a common mistake, I think, too, for some with Augustine, City of God, City of Man, to read that as church and state.
Yeah, I mean, there's this whole history of, you know, the two cities, the two swords, the two kingdoms, you know, none of which mean exactly the same thing, and right. None of which mean the same thing as church and state.
Right. So, but back to your point, Miles, about the church doesn't need the state to save souls. I mean, as much as I am a separation of church and state person, a spirituality of the church, which is kind of the Presbyterian version of 2K guy. I mean, I think about the history of foreign missions, modern foreign missions, but earlier, I mean, you can't go out of the mission field today without some kind of papers from either your state and or the state to which you're going. And if you're going somewhere like among some native tribe in South America, you might die, you know? So there's that. I mean, so the whole expansion of modern missions was bound up, you know, with those terrible things of colonialism and imperialism, but there was a lot of soul winning that happened through the agency of the state. And I'll make it even, I mean, harder for me as a kind of separation of church and state guy to also bring up that We don't even have doctrine without the state. I mean, Nicaea does not exist without Constantine. And, you know, whatever you make, I mean, there's almost nobody in the confessional Protestant world or the Roman Catholic world that would ever take on Nicaea. It is the golden rule of Trinitarian Orthodoxy. I mean, you can obviously have different readings, different phrases or clauses or whatever, but it is the gold standard. And if you are Trinitarian, that's how it goes. Well, you don't have, I don't know that the church would have ever had that kind of consensus without an emperor calling a council of bishops. And it's even true for Presbyterians. And I try to remind my tribe sometimes of this, that we don't have the Westminster Confession of Faith and Catechisms without Parliament calling this assembly together to write this up. And by the way, the first question and answer of the Westminster Shorter Catechism, which every Presbyterian loves, a man's chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. That's leading to the execution of a king. I mean, not directly, but it is. It's bound up with a civil war that's going to cost the king his life. So even Reformed Orthodoxy at that late stage of the Westminster Assembly, it has the fingerprints of government and the state all over it.
Well, sorry, go ahead, Corey.
Well, just very briefly to piggyback on that, I mean, we can say the same thing about, you know, the Augsburg Confession. I mean, that's the fundamental confession of Lutheranism. And it exists only because it was requested by the emperor at a political meeting of the empire. I want you to tell me exactly what you guys believe and what you practice so that we can sort out this issue of whether or not you should be tolerated in my empire, whether you should be exterminated. And so it's drafted by Melanchthon with the aid of theologians. But when it's presented to the emperor, the only people who sign it are the territorial princes of the Lutheran estates. So you're right. I mean, it's a weird thing. I mean, it's our first and fundamental confession is in some sense a kind of political document presented to a magistrate, signed by magistrates.
So much of this conversation, I think, has changed in the last 10 years, especially, let's be honest, since Trump, right? Like this, right. Trump changed everything. And so I think...
it's so bizarre that's true.
The most enthusiastic, disestablishmentarian, guys who are just convinced about the independence of church, I think historically have kind of viewed establishments as incidental to provincial history. Like, yeah, it was there. Mm-hmm. Like, it was incidental. Now it's become truly for like the accidental. Like this was actively something bad. And you have like respectable people saying, look, establishmentarianism is pretty close to heresy. Huh. Right. Like that's where this conversation's going. And I think it's not driven by anything other than kind of sociological considerations about politics. I mean, no one wants to admit this, but the Anglican Communion, the fact that the majority of Anglicans around the world are black, has everything to do with the Royal Navy. Like that's an uncomfortable truth, but it's completely true. The Royal Navy was really instrumental in setting up the sort of protective regime that allowed Anglicanism to flourish in West Africa. You have Royal Navy captains are basically going into these depots, anti-slave depots, because this is England, not America. And they're reading morning prayer to the few functionaries they've managed to find who've been taught English. Mm. And so the modern mission movement is predicated on, establishmentarian Whig protections of Anglo-American missionaries. And so you can say maybe some good came out of that, maybe bad, but the conversation has now gone from that was incidental to that was something actively horrifying. I can't believe the church was ever associated with that. And so I think so much of the energy around the conversation really has nothing more to do with, we've gone from being sort of like, oh, okay, that maybe that wasn't great. It's we like our settlement now. God was using that, whatever, incidentally. But now it's just this horrifying thing. And anything that even sounds like that is conservative Christians trying to create a theocratic order, right? And so I think 20 years ago, this conversation was a lot more sane than it is now. And I think so much of the insanity is just because of the Trump presidency, right?
Well, it wasn't. I would push back to the extent that I don't think it was as sane in reform circles, because theonomy was around and that drew heavily, of all things, on Dutch Calvinism. I'm not trying to say that you can't find theonomic elements in the Presbyterian world in Scotland, Covenanters. There's all sorts of sources you could get it there, but with neo-Calvinism, Kuyperianism, as it was called, and it, as it became, you know, Francis Schaeffer, who came up at, I think, our last conversation, but I mean, he popularized that stuff, but then it also took off in the evangelical world through evangelical colleges with the integration of world and life stuff. Yeah. Which became the mantra at evangelical colleges, so that, you know, that's a very light version of theonomy. But I do think if you're going to talk about the integration of faith and learning, you can also talk about the integration of religion and politics, or the integration of church and state. I mean, it's adjacent to integralism in conceptual ways, at least. And that troubled me for my old libertarian reasons, but so it's as you indicate, Miles, I'll let you get in there, Corey, sorry, but it is kind of an ever shifting set of conversations depending on what is going on in politics or sort of the bigger voices in popular expression of Protestantism.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned the old sort of theonomist, dominionist thing in sections of sort of middle 20th century Protestantism, because I'm always tempted kind of pessimistically to lament that Protestants are simply kind of following a few years behind whatever's happening in the Catholic world. So you mentioned Catholic integralism, which I think maybe complements, I don't know that it contradicts anything that Miles said, but I mean, there is a phenomenon here that in the last, say, 15 years, Catholics have started to wrestle seriously with the question of, can we harmonize, you know, 1,000 years of Catholic tradition and magisterial teaching with what the Second Vatican Council says about religious liberty? And a number of people have made arguments and have convinced a lot of other people that, yes, those can be harmonized, but the way to do so is by defending the old teaching. Namely, that, you know, a religious establishment is the preferred model. Persecution is perfectly okay when circumstances demand it. And that any kind of, you know, liberal tolerationist attitude is merely prudential when it's not possible to maintain an establishment. And so the Catholic integralist thing has kind of, you know, blown up big over the last decade or so. And I think that's probably partly prompted, you know, Protestant traditions to say, huh, this is interesting. I mean, we our traditions have gone through a similar sort of evolution, you know, from 16th century Lutherans being totally fine with, you know, established church and the persecution of Anabaptists to a kind of more liberal understanding. But can we really change our minds quite so easily? And so maybe do we need to rethink our being in bed with modern liberalism? So I mean, I think all the various traditions are probably going through some version of this rethinking, you know, is what we're doing today faithful to what our forefathers themselves thought? Or have we just kind of been swept along with the tide of modern liberalism without even recognizing it?
Miles, I'll give you the last word. We're probably
I think Corey's exactly right. I think that maybe one of the strange things about, at least Anglicans particularly on this, is nothing more than we don't like to write a lot of this stuff down.
that's right.
And so I think the reality on the ground for a lot of Anglicans is, again, it's not programmatic. It tends, like, all this stuff will tend to be rhetorical one way or the other. And I think part of that is because there's not the kind of legal textual tradition that you have, say, amongst the Reformed, and maybe to a lesser degree Lutherans too. So the entire conversation tends to be rhetorical. And I think the gift of that is that I don't know a ton of Anglicans who are trying to really get involved in political life to design specifically, say, what you might call theonomic constructions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that Anglicanism can't sound that way for certain people. Like, it can kind of do anything you want in that sense, precisely because this particular aspect of Christian intellectual life isn't written down for Anglicans. So you can have someone like Bishop James Madison in Virginia leading the charge on disestablishment and saying, look, we're Anglicans and this is totally consistent with our tradition. Thank goodness we don't have kings anymore. Thank goodness we don't have, an establishment anymore. And you have guys who are saying pretty much completely opposite things at the same time in Britain, saying like, oh my gosh, they're practically losing the faith. They don't believe in state church anymore. So I think it's sort of a, you can have whatever you like, at least when it comes to its ecclesiology on that. So,
all right. Well, we've said a lot. We could say a lot more, but we're out of time, and I know some of us need to go in different directions. So we'll stop there. Probably we'll come back to this at some point, but not necessarily the next recording, whenever that is. And thank you, listeners, whoever you are out there, and we will gather again, God willing, sometime soon. All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, thank you.